ready to vote on section 7? Is there a motion that section 7 be approved as written?
Well, we already got a motion to amend.
Alright. Motion is that the last section be deleted.
Sentence.
If the defendant objects to the scribe chosen by the state, etc. Any further discussion? Call the roll on the amendment.
Judge Burns?
No.
Pender Burns?
No.
Carson?
No.
Chandler? Frost?
Aye.
Paul?
Aye.
Jernigan?
I do not vote.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
Yes.
Foley?
For the amendment?
Yeah, delete the last sentence.
Oh, no.
Mr. Chairman?
No. Motion has been defeated, sir.
There's a motion. We got one coming up.
Is there a motion to adopt it?
I know.
You've heard the motion. Call a roll on adopting section 7 as written.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Pender Burns?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Frost?
Aye.
Hawk?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
No.
Foley?
Aye.
Aye. Gary. Section 8, George.
Section 8 is. Section 8 is designed. Section 8 is designed for a really rare and exceptional case. If under Section 2, a defendant raising partial responsibility is so successful that the jury runs away with itself and finds him not guilty of any crime, including a lesser included offense, where it should have found him guilty or could have found him guilty, and where the defendant is clearly appears after the evidence is in that the that he's mentally deranged, disturbed, and would be a danger to be on the street, the trial court is empowered to commit him under the civil commitment procedures. I don't expect it to happen very often, but it is a safety measure to protect the public in a situation where partial defense is too successful.
Safety measure. Success.
Well,
from what point of view?
I suppose that's a choice of terms is inappropriate. In a situation where a defendant is demonstrated by the evidence that he himself puts on, likely to be a threat to society. And the prosecution feels that the only safe place for him is in the institution. They may bring this action in the trial court where this is taking place, rather than having to go to another place, as under the civil commitment procedures. It incorporates by reference those procedures.
Those procedures require addition of two persons. Is that required under the permission as near as may be?
I suppose that wouldn't be a problem. Prosecution would conform to that technical detail by having an assistant to join them.
So they wouldn't have to have this section do that, would they?
Well, they'd have to go to another court, as I understand. Well, you recall the discussion with Ms. Jim and their subcommittee. If you go under the 426 procedure, you have to go to a different.
The probate court in a lot of counties.
If it didn't have this, then you'd have to go to a probate court, and as I understand it, let's see, at this point, the defendant would have been a verdict in the case, I assume, although it's possible that there might not yet be a verdict in the case. In which case, a probate court would not assume any kind of jurisdiction, as I understand it, correct? And where there's a case in a criminal court somewhere, the probate court will refuse any 426 proceedings with respect to the party.
What about the defendant had to be acquitted before the judge
would
do this?
I can't
remember
the word.
Well, I think that's correct. He'd have to be acquitted.
Oh, sure.
That's what it says.
Yeah.
And then he'd proceed in the same manner as though an application had been properly
It would still be possible, of course, aside from this provision, to go under 426, just straight under 426.
Well, now, Mr. Chairman.
After the case has been disposed of.
Yeah. You know, we've got, Mr. Chairman, isn't this just kind of a judgment, NOV? We've got a situation where he pleads, lesser defenses. Is there a problem? Yeah.
Well, what's wrong with that, really? We've got a man here who's shown signs of some mental disease and defect. And it seems to me that this is one place where we've got a safety valve. The court can say if it can show that he's in need of care, treatment, and custody, I believe that's the phrase under 426.
As opposed to being insane.
Committed.
Rather than turning loose on
Yes, rather than turning back on the street.
Got it.
It's written in conjunction with Section 9 of the Code of Break, and finding his of the partial or
Yeah.
You could have a man who would be totally acquitted on the facts of the case. Possibly not. The jury verdict comes back says he's acquittal, not a special finding. Mm-hmm. Section 9.
Well, he doesn't
still have the trial court the power to initiate the conference proceedings under Section 8 and 426.
This applies only on the
Still, the trial court has the burden of proof, still approved it, and then it should be put in.
Well, this applies only to Section 2.
Yeah, but Mr. Chairman, we're treating the amendment. It's just a matter of form. The judge, I agree with the clause from the cross, but I think the judge who might disagree with the jury. The jury may have found him innocent of the fact that the testimony of the defendant had nothing to do with his partial offense, defect, or whatever. No finding, just acquittal. And the judge says, I disagree. I'm going to initiate commitment proceedings. And it's kind of dangerous.
That's to prevent him from doing that anyhow.
Well, but if we...
doesn't have the jurisdiction, at least in our county.
Well, there's substantial reason generally, the fact that judges do not initiate commitment proceedings now. It's called being reelected every 6 years. It's called liable to slander. It's called something else.
No application has been filed.
He wants to prevent the district attorney himself from doing this.
My argument is, let's let the jury determine. If they say, you let this guy out because he's mentally affected, then let's kick the thing into gear and allow the judge to determine whether he got initiated proceedings. That's not what it says right now.
Section 8 says any acquittal of any kind is actually disentitled to Section 9 because it's going to be written or acquitted by reason of the lack of
if evidence has been introduced.
Well, yes, but if you introduce the evidence, but the jury verdict is simply a total jury,
that's right.
Then the court still has the power in under Section 8 to initiate the proceedings.
Your point is the jury may have said, well, we didn't believe anything about his mental condition. We think he's sound, but the evidence simply wasn't sufficient to convict him of anything.
I agree. You raise an interesting point, and let's take it one further. How do you know that the jury didn't find the man innocent with respect to the insanity charges, too? We have no disposition with respect to the guilt of the defendant.
Section 9 says you have to be acquitted on the grounds of mental disease and defect.
Yeah. They've got two verdicts. They can return not guilty, or they can return not guilty for reason of insanity.
Well, you have a very interesting point. I can't say that I can meet it.
How about Section
2? Section 2, but you're saying that under the there's another thing about this that let's say that say is acquitted, the only thing that the judge can do is trying to do something other than, like, if you have a partial responsibility defense that reduces, say, first degree murder to second degree or manslaughter, there's no problem. The judge will go ahead and sentence the defendant to be convicted of. But you get the situation where partial responsibility depends on his intent to unlawful entry, would be submitted to the jury, and so it's not really an unlawful entry, which may carry a penalty of up to 6 months in the county jail, when really if his mental condition is such, if the testimony of his mental condition is such, society would be better off if he was in the state hospital being treated for 6 months or a year or so, rather than having him sitting in the county jail.
Completely subjective judgment. But when you say the provisions of Chapter 426 shall apply, you've got two separate sets of circumstances in 426. You've got the sexually dangerous situation where the DA files a complaint, and then you've got the mental commitment deal where a petition with signed by two people brings the person before the probate court, and there's a different situation with respect to warrants. Different. And the question that I have in my mind is, assuming I'm the defendant, and I'm in Jim Burns' court, and I get acquitted, I'm free to walk out of that courtroom. And say he wants to initiate proceedings for my commitment. It's going to take a certain amount of time in order for him to gear up the machinery if we do it either way here, and it, I don't think it'd be enough for him to say to the sheriff, you keep that man in custody until I get two people to sign a complaint.
Until the judgment is signed, though, he's still in the custody of the law.
Usually when the judge accepts the verdict, he says, accepts it, and walks out.
Yeah, that's true, but until that judgment is signed, he's not off the hook.
I know.
But
usually I have to bury my judgment in the
So I think we have to polish up that procedural aspect of it.
Well, I think I agree with the modeling points of view, and I think the more it ought to be disposed of on the basic policy question of, do we want to have a stream on this kind of defendant at all?
I think you can really make a pretty good argument for that. But we have to remember, first of all, that the partial responsibility, we're talking about a fairly limited type of case, a fairly unusual situation. And there may well be darn good reason for some protection to society in the very rare situation where he'll wiggle off the hook instead of slipping on the balance of the coup. I don't, of course, all of these, you balance the interest of the individual versus the threat of the state.
I don't know what's in Chapter 426. Is there a procedure, for example, with police? Anything persons?
Two friends, two people that are acquainted with.
Or a doctor.
Yeah. Or a
county health officer.
Judge, even. Yeah, you.
Perhaps the section is unnecessary.
The doctor can do it alone.
There's a provision where they can put him in temporary custody anyway.
Yeah, but you have to have a hearing within 5 days.
Yeah.
It may very well be that this section is unnecessary in light of the existing 426 procedure.
But before you can do that, you
could be reached
by
somewhat delayed.
You want 426?
Someone is, say, obviously mentally ill, they pick him up and take him up to the hospital.
County
hospital. Used to be morning time, but now it's a county hospital. And then
usually it's in late at night or early in the morning, and then that gives the probate clerk time enough to get the papers made up, and then they come and have a hearing and have a problem. But they have, under the statute, they can pick them up and detain them for, I guess, well, 3 hours.
I think kind of concerned about is one, if you find the initial case on the basis of whether or not the defendant had, at the time the crime was suffering from such a defect that he wasn't able to create the proper mens rea of intent, and then you're trying the case, it could be a month later, or 2 months later, you're talking about intent, but not, he's not pleading insanity. The evidence says the situation would be relatively limited. You could have a verdict that the trial court would not agree with. I don't know. And would the judge, to ask the judiciary, would the judge really want that kind of responsibility? You kind of become a quasi prosecuting attorney.
John, one of the things I don't like the idea of assigning any validity to Chapter 426 to the way things ought to be done. I think that's the fact that our mental proceedings now are a model of the way to proceed. I realize how we get to this point, but I think that one of the dangers is assuming that what we do under 426 has any resemblance to a correct procedure. I know the legislature has been trying hard to resolve that problem, but I don't think we're there yet.
I think Dave had his hand up.
Just 2 points to make. The first is a practical one again, and that is that the average criminal case, discounting a first-degree murder, the defendant would probably have been admitted to bail at least until the 5 or 6 of the internet, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months. He's had a tremendous danger to society. He probably could have been picked up the way before then. I don't know if there's a reason from that to say it didn't commit any heinous act in public in the meantime, which is a good way. The second thing is, it says in the statute in 4.6, that any two people, and if during trial, the district attorney feels that there is a real danger, he's got any number of people available in the court now to sign the commitment papers and have it done that way. Which leads to the conclusion is that there's simply no reason to mug up the federal law.
The DA has to stay out of it, because I've just been calling psychiatrists testifying that the man is sane. I've just been standing up and arguing up and down to the jury that this man is sane. And then I turn around the minute the fool comes up and say, God, she's crazy as hell.
You don't like the sheriff or anything?
You
can admit you were wrong, can't you?
Yeah, that's the problem, right? The judge, the jury determines you're wrong. This
you're
is
not talking about sanity.
But then you're putting you're giving the DA the sour grape to, like you say, you don't know whether the jury acquitted him outright, determined he didn't do the act, or whether there's a partial responsibility. So then you can really, when the DA files it, then you can say it's all a sour grape. But the judge, at least I feel, at least in our kind, the judge is basically or impartial, maybe
800% of the jury. That's Benton Hanging County, Oregon.
Don't trust the judge's determination as to where the jury reached its verdict, and how it reached its verdict, and why it did, and what the testimony was, and so whether or not to initiate the judicial proceedings.
Jeremy?
Yes.
I have a motion which I am not personally in favor of, but I think will at least give us the issue. I move that we dispense with Section 8.
Delete it?
In its entirety.
You've heard the motion. Further discussion? Call the roll.
Judge Boone?
No.
Senderman?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Frost?
Aye.
Haas?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Knight?
No.
Baldy?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
6 ayes.
Carry.
Same world.
It might be better if you don't want something.
I have a message to send. Now that I'm needed to be a commissioner, well, it says I have a 16-year-old girl out of the car. Are we legal? No signature.
What is?
She's under age. She's under the age of 6. He couldn't write.
She brought up here. Section 8 has been deleted. Section 9. Will become Section 8, I suppose.
condition of means. Section 9 reflects what was the law in slightly different, I think, more economical language, requiring that when a defendant is found not guilty on the grounds that he was not responsible, that the verdict judgment shall so state. Now, there was some discussion of this in the original full commission hearing, that there ought to be some legislative history to reflect, rather than saying exactly what the judgment should state, that the history of the section should state within the comment how the verdict should read. And that is incorporated. And the appropriate part of the verdict, as part of our commentary, should read, quote, not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect excluding responsibility.
Rather
that was agreed upon some time ago, rather than insanity.
Yeah.
We want to avoid that phrase.
Why don't we have this apply both to sections 1 and 2?
Well, wouldn't that, however, wouldn't that give the district attorney
he's that concern in those cases?
Some evidence that there may be necessity.
What if he isn't quite as attorney?
On the first one, no, on section 2, it was partial responsibility. He wasn't able to do the mental defects or direct mental intent.
But you don't find them not guilty with.
You don't need it there.
You can find them not guilty with a lesson.
Wouldn't the jury have
to change the form of the verdict?
I don't think you should have found this.
No. Because the thrust of section 2 is that you will be, let us say, not guilty of burglary, but guilty of unlawful entry or whatever it might be.
I suppose our. You think our legislative
because section 2 doesn't produce an acquittal
that normal we mean that they could also be acquitted as far as
section 2 produces conviction of a lesser included.
Actually, I don't know.
If it produces acquittal under 2, it would be the same as under 1. In other words, if your mental defect excuses you of committing the crime, deprives you of the intent, the wrongfulness,
is the same
as under 1.
If you got
a special verdict,
you're not getting there.
Well, it could be just a series of problems. Mr. Brunton is just a danger in the case. As far as the
if there's simply a verdict of acquittal when the defense of mental disease or defect has been raised by the defense, I suppose it would mean that they have found that he is safe, that he is responsible, but the state hasn't proven in his case.
You have three forms of verdict. Guilty, not guilty, and
real by not, yeah.
I wonder if we shouldn't redraft section 9 to provide that this particular form of verdict can be entered only when finding the acquittal is by reason of.
Well, that's what it says.
No, it's just, you could have two or three other. I'll leave a jury question.
Well,
is you instruct them that they enter this verdict only if they find that the only reason they're putting you in the jury is.
Wouldn't that follow, or is it with reference to section 1?
Sure, right.
Yes, it's defined in section 1. That's right. It's set out.
Yeah, you have three forms of verdict.
Well,
one not guilty, and not guilty by reason of sentence. Only you say it differently.
Your commentary shows the language that we use.
Can you sign and return one form? One form?
I'll renew my note. Motion, Mr. Chairman.
Motion is to adopt section 9. Any further discussion?
I move the previous question.
Call roll. Next section.
Section 10, I believe, is perhaps the heart of the entire article. once the verdict is in, by way of preface, Don Paulette has already pointed out that the Legislative Council's office has indicated that it would, when the time arrives, resection this, that is, break section 10 down into shorter sections. It certainly is advisable. But we'll deal with it here in its very lengthy form as one section. And if we approve, or whatever form it's finally approved in, that would be a technical drafting job to go ahead and adjust the section into smaller, more manageable pieces against the future possibility that one segment might need to be amended, and there's no sense setting having to set out, as our rules require in the state, a number of pages of typewriting to accomplish a relatively minor change. Now, that doesn't go to the substance of the section. The section is designed in the first place for dealing with the defendant who has been found not guilty by reason of mental defect, excluding responsibility, or insanity in shorthand here. And when that point is reached, the initial provision is that the court shall, on the basis of evidence given at the trial or at a separate hearing, make any of the following orders. Now, those orders might be: one, commitment, because the defendant is in mentally diseased and defect, and is dangerous to himself and the public, and therefore ought to be committed. Or two, he can be discharged entirely on the grounds that he, even if he is mentally diseased or mentally defective, within the responsibility rule, is still not dangerous to the public or himself. He may be released entirely. Or third, a mixture of the two, if he is suffering from a mental disease or defect and is dangerous but is not so dangerous as to warrant commitment, he can be released on supervision to the community on such terms of supervision as the court might impose. Now, the first thing that I mentioned is, and one of the problems that you have to deal with here, is how the court makes this determination. And we say it can make that determination on the basis of evidence given at the trial or at a separate hearing. Now, this poses some interesting problems because the question on commitment looks at the defendant at the time of the end of the trial. And the question, of course, of insanity looks at it at the time of the act, the criminal act, and there may be some intervening months, during which time, it's very possible that the mental condition of the defendant will improve radically to the point where he's no longer insane. Now, that would be a rarity, probably. But, as a practical matter, I'm informed by numerous trial judges. Judge Burns took a survey of some of his colleagues in Multnomah County, and I surveyed informally the Lane County situation. And the situation is this: at the trial, where insanity is raised as a defense, in many, if not most cases, the evidence put on by the psychiatrist, and not only goes to the time of the act, but also, presently, the condition of the defendant. And there is ample evidence to warrant the judge looking at the evidence given in the trial to determine whether this defendant, as of this moment, should be committed or released. Now, if that evidence does not exist at the trial, it isn't put on by the experts, or the court feels that it's inadequate, he may, but does not have to require, a special separate hearing on the question of commitment. Now, this poses some problems. You can certainly say that if the judge goes on the basis of the evidence given at the trial and simply commits without a hearing, that there's a due process question. The defendant doesn't get a chance, as Judge Burns or Senator Burns pointed out, doesn't get a chance to argue the issue. Well, that's a very real problem, I suppose, and it comes down to the fact of, would it do any good or would it do more harm to require a separate hearing in every case, when in fact the practice now indicates that separate hearings are not requested or not desirable or not useful. So we've taken, and this is the model penal code, not the model penal code provision, because it provides for automatic commitment following not guilty by reason of insanity. That clearly, I think, now more clearly, is a due process question. We provided then for the evidence being used at the trial, if it's appropriate and adequate, or for a separate hearing on the issue of commitment.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Some of the women believe in the adversary system. undermined when he sat through a trial, argued vehemently that this man is perfectly sane, and then he has to turn around and say that this man should be put away in the hospital for his pain.
Didn't have to.
What?
Didn't have to do that if he doesn't believe it.
Well,
matter of fact, you probably should.
All right, so what
everybody changes sides at this hearing. The defendant is now sane, and I'm not as insane as I said I was at the trial. It depends on which way you look at it. And it's an anomaly, you're right.
Insane now,
or
the time
you
committed the act.
What I'm saying is that maybe the one person who hasn't committed himself is the judge, and we ought to stick it on his back.
Why can't you provide for a separate hearing but allow the court to take judicial notice of the testimony introduced during the course of the trial?
Well, I don't know. Of course, you can say that you think there's a serious due process question if there's an automatic commitment. Isn't that really what the defendant is requesting? He's saying that I'm crazy, I'm wrong.
No,
I
don't
know.
I'm saying
that might have felt good.
That
thing happened, I was...
That was the issue then. I was insane when I shot. The issue is different now. I'm no longer insane. By shock treatments or the advances, the miracle advances of psychiatry and children.
Yes.
The shock is getting arrested.
Right. And it's not very rare that happens. I mean,
it's a fairly philosophical question. Are we somewhat, again, far away from the criminal law and what it should be doing in this area? We've overlooked this big hole again between the entry of plea and the time of trial. Whether or not the guys would be released and there, I think we might be a real danger to society and to myself. Shouldn't we have the whole thing done on a civil commitment basis and feel like we should be able to
do it? Well, that may be possible, but certainly not under the present civil commitment statute, where the test is entirely different. I recall the phrase is in need of due or care, treatment, and custody. That's entirely different than criminal insanity. I suppose if you agree, we've got this defendant who has a tremendous amount of publicity. The public has been looking at him and reading about his trial, and they find out he's insane. The jury says he's insane. Therefore, the defendant ought to stay in a separate channel to be disposed of as a flowing out of this community determination of his insanity, rather than shifting him away back into the civil commitment procedure. Right.
He is using the present tense, though, about that. He said that was insane.
Yeah, but civil commitment, too, relies on people that have personal knowledge of the fact to file this petition. And those people who have personal knowledge aren't really the deputies that you have around. They're people that know the defendant, probably have got up and testified for him during the course of the trial, his psychiatrist, and they sure the heck aren't going to turn around now and file the petition.
Well,
so
the deputy calls him anyway.
And he probably doesn't have sufficient personal knowledge, too, with a good deal of knowledge signed this petition.
Well, a lot of insanity defenses are pegs for the jury to hang their hat on when nobody thinks the guy is insane at all. That's the trouble. I got shot at a shooting coming. And you're going to put a guy that is insane, and everybody knows he's insane. For instance, one time I defended a guy named a Suter over in Polk County. And shot the deputy marshal because the deputy marshal was doing the wrong thing for the guy's wife. And we went in and admitted that he shot him and killed him. And I had old John Evans from the Superintendent State Hospital, the father of the President John Evans, to examine him, and down to the heat saying, you know, his hair didn't know his little bit.
That's your kind of
he said, you give D.C. Burke, he thinks everybody's insane.
Yeah, there are those.
So I said, I'll do without a doctor, and I called various people around there that know different things, that he was incoherent at the time of this shooting and a whole lot of stuff. And then during the trial, I said, I called up Evans, and I knew him real well. I said, won't you come over and just talk about insanity? Just say something about it. Yeah, I can do that for you. So he did, and he made a speech and said he didn't believe in the misnomer rule and a lot. this stuff and just stand around these, and the jury found the guy not guilty in about 5 minutes. And
was there a DA in the case?
Yeah. Bob Friesen, and he was assisted by the Attorney General's office. And Friesen insisted that we hold the guy for commitment because the way it looked to the public, here, this guy knew he did this, and it would look like the devil if we don't do something about it. And Judge Walker said to me, won't you advise him to stay in jail until tomorrow till we can figure out what to do? And I said, no, I would advise him he has the right to break out of that jail. And so Walker said, let him go. And he went and got him on the phone ever since. And the district attorney attempted to get somebody that wouldn't sign a complaint. Nobody felt there was any basis for it. Insanity.
Was he acquitted not guilty by reason of insanity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, before the statute.
But before this statute.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my point is, in Section 10, George, you set out the procedure at great length, but in essence, you're not departing from what we can do now under 136.730, are you?
Saying how to do it.
Saying specifically how to do it, and we're also filling in a lot of blanks that I haven't discussed yet.
Well, are you objecting to the present statute that we have?
No, I think it's advisable by the time.
We're allocating some burdens of proof.
I don't think we should do anything that presumes that because the guy was convicted, because the guy was acquitted by reason of insanity, that he probably ought to be committed. Do not affect having some superior way of finding out.
It seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that this draft meets that objection much better than 136.730. Mr. Spaulding says that.
Well, I think what Bruce is saying essentially is that what you should have is a hearing, a separate hearing, unless the defendant sees fit to waive the necessity. That's what he's saying. In fact, we argued this back and forth in subcommittee, and the ultimate decision was to do it this way, although we make the strong argument that unless the defendant waives a second hearing, we never get one. Obviously, there will be some cases where it will be clearly necessary, and probably the largest number of cases, though, such a hearing would be totally unnecessary.
Maybe retrying the case.
Well, I'm sure the whole thing is being tried. A lot of times will be before the court again, and perhaps relying too much on what actually takes place in Multnomah County. But you bring both doctors in, and they both get on the stand and say, "Yeah, he was insane at the time," and also they throw in some material that. How he is now, and how recently they examined him, and what his condition is now. And you go ahead, you find him not guilty by reason of insanity, and you've just heard these people talk. And you know perfectly good well you're going to send him to the state hospital.
That's why I think this
The commission may feel, as a matter of policy, they want to insist on a separate hearing unless the defendant waives it.
Position there is when you're developing your expert witness testimony, of course you're aiming primarily to find the expert submitted. But knowing this additional hearing may be coming up if you're very successful, then you also have to work on pretty heavily about the here and now. And I can see a lot of cases that would be What am I going to do if I get a doctor who says, you bet your life he was crazy as a coot in the that time, I'm going to pay something else. He's also crazy as a coot right now. As you read the statute, the same as when you put away, at least in a situation for 5 years, you chance for an additional period. You're dealing with a man who's probably incompetent to give you instructions, but you can look at that one. You say, look, I didn't get you out in the first one, but you're your doctor, and...
It's a very interesting point. How in the world can a defendant waive a hearing? It's a serious question.
as far as I know, it's unsettled. I couldn't find any cases about it. But if that defendant is in fact incompetent to proceed, at least, or insane, how can you waive anything? How can you waive a right?
Well, of course, you're talking about insane at the time that he committed the act, and this is some time later.
Yeah, it's a question that's never been, as far as I know, dealt with, and I just assume avoid it.
Without the statute, you simply hold back on later information. I simply question the doctor on the attitude of the property on the area around the time when it was
charged. That's like the guy who's drug.
Right.
How can he give consent to the breathalyzer test?
Well, actually, Don makes the point. We're not really changing the system that exists. What we're trying to do is clarify situations which had always been unclear, and especially with some respect to some items I haven't mentioned yet, fill in some very large gaps in our present statutory system.
Roger,
you had a nice
position. I don't think the whole darn thing should be a part of the criminal law. It's a civil procedure, and I would like to.
I had to make this happen tonight. I feel that if there were not a provision such as this in this statute, the result would be fewer acquittals by reason of consent.
That's right.
And so, I mean, from my standpoint, just simply the convicting that of crime, I don't care whether there's this type of statute here or not.
We're talking about a separate crime.
Well, I would say in response to Dave, I think you have to take a question. Regardless of maybe the different opinion, label, symbolizing insanity. I think without this,
we've
gone a long way to ensure that we
I think that's the first really valid point you've made all day.
Chairman?
Judge Burns?
It seems to me that really it would be perhaps more useful if we have George explain the whole section, basically outline the whole section, because I think once you get the whole thing laid out, and among other things, I think this question of whether it has to be a separate hearing or not will really kind of become perhaps a subsidiary point. It seems to me the whole thing is.
I think that's a good point. George, do you want to go ahead and?
Then after observing the three things the judge may do, that is commit, release on supervision, or discharge, the situation is this: if he decides to commit, the hospital must retain that defendant committed to it for at least 90 days before any release procedures can be instituted. Under the present situation, and I hesitate to use the word law because it's not clear by statute, presently, a defendant sent to the state hospital by a judge following this insanity verdict may be released by the doctor immediately. Maybe in one door and out the other, because of the former attorney general's opinions taken in conjunction with 426, the superintendent of the state hospital has that power now. This is one of the major defects, I think, in the view of the subcommittee and the view of the model penal code and most new codes of any release procedure. The decision ought not to be medical because the original decision to convict him by reason of insanity, is not a medical decision either. It's a legal decision. The insanity test is a legal test and not a medical test, although, of course, it relies on medical testimony. Therefore, the community represented in the jury or the judge has placed the defendant in the insane asylum or the state hospital, in modern terms, and it ought to be up to the judge or to release, to express the community ethic, community feelings again about mental defect and disease. And this draft would provide that only after application by the state superintendent, if he feels that the discharge is in order, after a hearing, the judge may release. Or, the person who has been committed himself is now given, in addition to the habeas corpus proceeding, is allowed to petition after the 90-day period for his release and to have the issue tried at the hearing. We also provide there, by the way, that the person may not petition more often than once every 6 months to remove some of the repetition in that kind of situation. Now, further, the person once committed or released on supervision may be kept in that status for a period of 5 years. At the end of that 5-year period, if he's still on release, or if he's still committed in the state hospital, he automatically is entitled to a hearing on the condition of whether he should stay there or stay on release. If he's in the hospital itself is responsible for notifying the committing court 30 days prior to the expiration of the 5-year date. A hearing then must be held on the continued status of this particular defendant, we're calling the defendant for ease, identification. The state superintendent may recommend at that hearing, the 5-year hearing, that he be discharged. Or he may recommend that he be kept in continued confinement, or he may recommend release on supervision or continuation of the present status. Now, the issue at the hearing, whether it be on the 5-year hearing or the issue on petition in the interim by the person who's been confined, is always twofold. Is he insane within the test originally at his trial, and is he still dangerous? If he's still insane but not dangerous to his own person or persons of society, and we're leaving property danger out of this thing, is he dangerous to the persons of others or himself? If he's insane and dangerous, he may not be discharged or released. If he's merely insane and he can prove, psychiatrist can assist him in proving that he's no longer dangerous, he must be released. Now, this is a major change, which reflects, I believe, the modern trend in the insanity release procedures. Now, the problem that exists with respect to burden of proof is a major problem, and this draft also attempts to deal with that. In allocating in each particular kind of hearing, at each particular stage, who has the burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence? In the situation with respect to the original commitment, the original release on supervision, or the original discharge, the subcommittee makes no recommendation with respect to allocation of the burden, whether it should be with the state or with the defendant. The commission is asked to decide that on those three issues. But with respect to subsequent hearings, that is where the applicant, that is where the person confined himself applies for release, he being the applicant for release must show by a preponderance of the evidence that he is not that he's insane and no longer dangerous, or that he's not insane at all, in which case he can be released. And he has the burden there. However, if the state superintendent, for instance, recommends that he be kept continued beyond the 5 years, or recommends that the release on supervision be revoked and that he be committed, there the motion or the moving party, being the state, must bear the burden. So we've tried to follow the petitioner to allocate the burden of proof in a much, we think, fairer way to deal with the individual. And I think that, now there's one further point, and then I'm sure there are some things I've forgotten, but one further point. Now let's assume that at the end of the 5-year period, the superintendent has recommended that he not be released, or that he continue in confinement because he's insane and dangerous, and the defendant fails to prove is entitled to release. He may be continued in confinement under those provisions indefinitely. And this is purposeful, of course, where we got a very dangerous person who, as long as he remains insane within the original test, may be kept in the state hospital, kept off the streets. But that would be a rarity, we assume, the kind of individual that's going to be locked up for life. And he must provide himself for that kind of situation. But at least, he's entitled that every 6 months after the 5-year period, petition for his release again. He's not going to be locked away where he can't even hear the dogs bark. He's going to have a chance periodically to try his present mental condition.
George, I think you were in error in one respect. After the 5 years, when the superintendent says that he should be continued in confinement, you said unless the defendant is able to prove that he shouldn't, the burden is maybe on the state at that point to prove. Yeah. John?
Well, this, I think, George, is substantially similar to the Maryland law. There's a number of states have it. I favor it. I'll tell you why. I think if we're going to liberalize the insanity, perhaps I disagree with you on this, state, but I think it goes hand in hand with the criminal code, and this should be tied in with the perhaps insanity. And if we're going to liberalize the insanity rule, and part of the document go to ALI. That we need to spell out the procedures a little bit more definitively than they have in the past. I have much greater confidence in a judge making the decision on the release of a person from state hospital than I do on the superintendent of the state hospital, or I do in the superintendent of the state hospital making that decision. I just think that it's a crime the way the authorities of the state hospital have turned out, who I'm sure would never have been turned out as casually had they gone before a court. And I think this case of the guy up in Arlington that killed the state policeman is a perfect example. The only question I have, George, is on this business of over on page 27, where a person can be released if he's insane but doesn't present a substantial danger to himself or the person of others, or the person of others. What about the arsonist? The arsonist, quite often, that ends up committed on insanity acquittals.
Wouldn't he be dangerous to other persons then?
Well,
that's the crux of the crime of arson.
Well,
by the way, I would refer, are you looking at preliminary draft number 4 or 5?
Yeah,
you ought to look at 5 because it's a major change.
Well, that's that.
Language is different, but it isn't changed.
All right, and in as a matter of semantics, I think you're going to have to change the superintendent of the state hospital because the need for argument that we sent into the superintendent.
Well, we recognize that this particular terminology would have to be changed ultimately. We thought we put it in there and then we wrap it up fine and we'll change that.
I can't hear you.
On page 13, I presume.
May I interrupt you just a moment? You ought to be looking at preliminary draft number 5. Is that the one you're using?
That's all right.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure. John was using the old draft. There's a lot of difference.
I just presume that the hearings are going to tell that this has been committed as to whether or not it's going to be closed. Maybe a hearing as I think of the dream of all the substantive due process protections. And I notice here in the second paragraph here that the court may appoint one or more psychiatrists to examine the person to submit reports. His opinion as a medical condition is such. Is the intention of the draft of the report for such error an application made because of the outcome? Doctor so and Doctor so and so, and you got to submit people down and examine them, and he has to cooperate, and you send your reports, you can all read them, and you can submit all the reports you have, or something like that, that you make a decision without requiring the physicians to testify in court, and cross examination.
Well, I certainly.
Why don't you explain this versus growth?
Well, it says submit reports. I know it's a. If I represent a man for under 5 years, and with conviction that he should be released, I'll be damned. I don't want psychiatric reports to be going into the court, and I object to it now under the conciliation situation in this modern times, really. And to have those, to read those, to formulate them,
the subcommittee addressed itself directly to your point, but my feeling is, and I agree with you, there ought to be every opportunity for cross-examination in this kind of hearing. And if
subcommittee, I don't think it intended any other result. Now, we suggest here, the language is restrictive in that it talks about reports which would indicate or which would imply that the person confined has no right to cross-examine. Well, now, I think that I would be, I'm not so sure that that would be the result, but if there's any doubt about it, I would object certainly making some explicit assertion there as the right to cross-examine. And I will point out that with respect to the incompetency hearing, which we're going to strike pretty soon, there is a provision specifically that the court, and this is a situation where the court has its own psychiatrist appointed to determine whether the defendant can help himself in his own case. This isn't on the issue of insanity. And we provide very purposely here to allow reports to be used instead of witnesses to be produced, but we also provide, nevertheless, if the defendant wants to cross-examine, he has the right. And in short, in the incompetency hearing, to cut down on unnecessary hearings, where no one wants one anyhow, that the
parties stipulate.
Yeah, right. So to be consistent with that incompetency proceeding, would certainly we could insert some kind of language here to show that he also has a right to cross-examine and bring in his own witness, if he wanted to make it that more specific.
Just going to the says, of course, can be submitted and filed with the court.
My impression was that this was the addition to everything else that the hearing was part of the
made. We did not intend to apply to have a, you know,
but we may be sure to have a spell out.
Now, sub 4 says the court shall conduct a hearing, and I think
no,
it was, you know, and we felt it was implicit in that, but I don't think we discussed it. Particular point.
That's
a hearing would
consist
of testimony.
Yeah, but it's implicit that the defendant is going to be able to call these people in the court who made the report, but if there's any doubt, I certainly
Couldn't we, by appropriate commentary, spell this out?
Well, I think we probably could because it says the court shall conduct a hearing on any application for abuse, discharge, so on, filed pursuant to this section, to the whole section. And that means Dave's probably commentary would be sufficient to show that what Harold's referring to here is something in addition to the regular due process and confrontation.
Well, several things. One, we've all had these situations where the reports are forwarded to court and you're going to court that day and the judge is doing the job he should do. We view the file, the reports in the file, the read the reports. I don't think any lawyer would walk into that situation without feeling like he's fighting an uphill battle if the reports are accurate in the situation. Secondly, something that I've come up against, and just think a matter of practicality of trying a case, the cost factor in having someone available such as a psychiatrist. I know in Roseburg, on comp cases, I had a situation down there where we go outside the scope of maybe a limited examination. The state required me to pay the cost of the expert witnesses because I went one iota beyond the scope of the direct examination. And I think there's another factor, who's going to produce it? If the reports are there, the doctor should be, I don't know if the report should go in without the stipulation.
You feel that if a report does go in, the court appoints a psychiatrist.
You know, it makes most of these things probably handled. The reports that go in from the psychiatrist, and they're probably assigned. If I had a case,
but the incompetent should be permitted to have the right to cross-examine even those psychiatrists who submitted to prepare a report for the court.
Certainly.
Maybe it should be spelled out a little more.
We certainly didn't mean to restrict any of the due process aspects of this particular
matter. I just think as a lawyer, when you start out your competency hearing and the judge has already reviewed the two psychiatric reports.
And his two men.
You know, and here you are, and you've got one. He's already read these two, and just, you know, kind of a tough situation.
Isn't it just a matter of when your uphill battle starts, whether it starts the morning before the hearing or after the hearing?
I really had the judge the first time, any case, to hear the testimony of a medical witness in that courtroom when a cross examination to get your teeth in, rather than having read that doctor's report before you ever get there.
Well, this kind of complaint, I assume, most of the cases, and there will be just a very short hearing, and the judge will decide on the basis of these reports, and the guy won't have any money.
Wouldn't it be better if, instead of providing that the court may appoint one or more psychiatrists to submit reports, that at the hearing the court may designate one or more psychiatrists to examine the incompetent, or whatever you want to call him, and then testify at the hearing instead of submitting a written report?
Well, is that really necessary? Because then we have to drag the expert into court.
It won't be, and I said the court may.
Oh, I see.
May.
The court may determine to do it either way.
Yes.
There's a practical thing about it. Of course, these people are, if they are really the same, they're still going to be in there every 6 months.
Yeah.
And we'll have to have a right to be there. Where to draw the line and give them a short shift or have an error.
Well, I suppose what we do is pick up the language from section 13 on termination of fitness to proceed. It gives the defendant the following right. That's the way it's expressed there. If the report is received in evidence upon such hearing, the party shall have a right to summon and cross-examine the psychiatrist or psychiatrist who submitted the report and to offer evidence upon the issue. Other evidence regarding the defendant's mental condition may be introduced by either party. That removes any doubt.
Where are you reading that from?
That's from section 13.
Page 26.
It's page 26. Mm-hmm. And that's in the incompetency to proceed.
Where would you put that?
Working in the last
Well, I'd move the amendment of subsection 4 to reflect that language in substance, and ask that we empower the staff to work it in and bring it back.
You've heard the motion. The essence of the motion is that sub 4 be amended in such a manner that it will incorporate the rights to the defendant or the incompetent that are contained in section 13. Is there any objection? All those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion's carried. Don, you will then put that in. Now you go to sub 5, don't you?
I have to do it.
Or,
well,
no, you
have to do
it.
Subsection 3, besides the burden of proof.
Yeah, subsections 1, 2, and 3, you all have the same issue. I put them in brackets. The last sentence of sub 1, the last sentence of sub 2, I guess the last sentence of each one of those has the same decision And I would assume that if you decide one, that they all ought to all be the same. That was what I suggested. If you decide the state should have the burden, it ought to be uniform on all three of the issues, or vice versa with the defendant. The subcommittee had no recommendation, but it felt that the commission ought to make the allocation. This is on the original hearing. It's the original determination by the court following the verdict of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect.
I think, George, that necessarily follows in sub one. It's when he's found not to be affected by the mental disease or defect, and if he is, he's no longer a substantial danger to himself or a person of others. Then it seems to me there, perhaps it wouldn't be wrong to have the burden upon the defendant, but in the others, where there's a finding that which may result in his confinement or being placed under supervision, I think that it wouldn't be inappropriate to have the burden upon the state.
Yes.
Where's this?
I'm not sure I understand.
Yeah, well, there are three situations. One is where he's found not to be no longer affected by the mental disease or defect, or that he's no longer presents a substantial danger to himself or the person of others. Now, of course, he'll be released if that happens. In that situation, it would seem to me that the burden perhaps should be on the defendant. However, in the other two situations, where the finding is that he is still suffering from the mental disease or defect, or that he presents a substantial danger to himself or the person of others, then the result of those findings is going to be that he will either be placed in confinement or he'll be placed under supervision. Therefore, I feel that the burden should be on the state in the latter two situations and on the defendant in the former first.
I'm not.
Well, then what do you do?
There's a situation
where you've got the burden of proof that.
Well, but wait a minute. This is the original hearing, Tony. And what you're doing is saying you're allocating the burden of proof after the result is null. In other words, this is the hearing that takes place immediately after the verdict comes in. Now, what you're saying is if he's going to be released, the burden is on him. But you don't know that until you've had the hearing. You have to allocate the burden of proof before the hearing is held. Whose burden is it?
Proof is on the prevailing party.
It's strange to me that you have the state having the burden of proving that this man is no longer affected by this.
Of course, the way this is drafted, it causes the problem. Actually, the issue in 1 and 3 is the same. It's stated differently, but it's exactly the same. In sub 1, the judge is empowered to release. In sub 3, he's empowered to commit. All right, the issue and the burden on that is really the same. It should be on the same party.
That's right.
Well, it should be on the state then.
Yeah, I think you're right.
All the way through.
It should be on the state myself. But it ought to be uniform, at least in 1 and 3, because it's the same issue.
Well,
yeah,
in other words,
at the same time.
The question you want answered is, you're going to have a hearing and you want to find out, is he dangerous or isn't he? Shorthand, it's a little more. But that's basically what you're saying. And you say, okay, if I find he's dangerous, lock him up. If I find he's not dangerous, let him go.
Or if I find that he's partially dangerous, I supervise.
But the question is he dangerous or isn't he? Now,
why should the burden be on anyone?
Well,
it doesn't have to be.
Why should it be on anyone?
What are you going to do in the case of lack of evidence?
It seems to me there's a certain amount. Two is the real guts issue.
What, supervision?
No, I'm looking at substitute.
There is a statute. I ran across a statute in Oregon on it's a compensation section. Industrial, I guess.
Well,
where there is a provision that the burden shall be on neither party. It's a peculiar allocation.
Yeah,
it says neither party shall have the burden of proof. So there is a precedent in their statute for that kind of approach.
Well, it just seems odd to me. The district attorney is going to have the burden of showing that this fellow is going to be released. Something tells me, well, now this DA just got through losing this case, and he isn't now going to try to convince this court that the guy no longer is affected, and so he's going to turn him loose. inherent inconsistency some way in it to me.
Well, isn't the logical, the logical presumption, seems to me, to put the burden upon the defendant to prove that the man is not dangerous because he is devoted the trial to proving the man is insane.
Well, that was my first suggestion.
And, so it seems to me that...
Well, doesn't that ignore the time difference, though? Are we back
to but the logical presumption...
There's a presumption of what's shown to exist.
What you're burdened with.
But that presumption is saying, too.
Not at this point.
No. The jury's found that.
But you get to the point that the only ones sane among us, those who've been in the institution, been released because they've been adjudicated sane. The rest of us haven't had that privilege. I mean,
we're all presumed sane.
Well, no, but are we then saying that once the adjudication is that he was insane at the time, then the burden would necessarily follow hereafter until some adjudication by a psychiatrist or a judge that you are insane until proven sane? And once you're proven, once you beat it under the fence of insanity.
Now, of course, the issue is not insanity anymore.
Well,
the issue is now dangerousness, which is an entirely different issue. It hasn't been tried at the trial. At the trial, we simply determined that because of mental disease or defect, he's not responsible for his acts. But he may not be dangerous at all. Maybe like the defendant that Bruce Spaulding just mentioned, who shot his wife's lover. And that was the only criminal act or quasi-criminal act that man has ever committed in life. And he ought not to be held in an institution and, in fact, discharged any mental problems that he ever had with it. And psychiatrists agree with that. They say a man who kills is maybe absolutely sane thereafter because he solved his problems by that.
But the point is that the man, it just seems to be a matter of logic, the man has committed a dangerous act, right?
Well, you're assuming it's a dangerous act,
It's a danger to society in some way, shape, or form, or he shouldn't be
enforced. In the popular view, this guy is dangerous. And one reason we're going about it this way is we believe that if we liberalize the test, we want to put some teeth into the release procedure. And this fella has just got through persuading the jury that he's dangerous.
But he was dangerous.
And he was dangerous.
Yes.
The fact of business is, and even though it's been 3 or 4 months, the fact of business is, in the popular mind, we got to do something about this guy. We say so because we've got this elaborate procedure, and we're taking it out of the hands of the doctors because we think they make poor decisions, which increases the danger to the community. So why then shouldn't we? Logically, I agree with Lee. You can say that at the end of the trial, you have your hearing on, is he dangerous? It seems to me that it's not unfair to say, buddy, you've got to prove to me that you're not dangerous right
now. Well, you disagreed with me a moment ago on that same thing.
And right at that time, he'd have to go forward with the evidence and marshals and psychiatrists, and he's in no position to do it.
Well, what do you mean? He's got his own psychiatrist who says, yes, I testified to that at the time.
First stage, but the verdict should be on the defendant. Because the result of that finding will be a release of this man upon society. The other two cases, the result will be that he's confined or placed under supervision. It affects him in a different way. And therefore, I think at that the latter two stages, it should be on the state. Because the issue isn't what you said, Jim. The issue is this. The issue is at the time of this hearing.
Is this man?
Yes. At that time.
Right.
That's when
is
it's
he
found.
Danger?
Is he no? Is he suffering from a mental disease or defect? And if so, is he dangerous to himself or the person of others? Right. That's the issue in each of these in that hearing. All right. Now, if it's found at that first hearing that this man is, he's not suffering from he's no longer suffering from a mental disease or defect, or if he is, he is no longer dangerous to himself or the person of others, he's released, isn't he? Now, it seems logical to me at that point then, since he will be released, that burden should be on the defendant.
Yeah, but you've got to place the burden before you start that hearing.
Well, what difference does it make? We know what the result's going to be.
Well, why do you
aren't you talking about the way the statute should be worded? That's what you're talking about. Is that what you're getting at?
No. What I'm getting at is that in sub 1, it should be the defendant, and in sub 2 and 3, it should be the state.
But you're talking about...
You're talking about the same theory.
You're going to come out...
Yes.
In other words, you're saying that the defendant should... The state should have the burden of proving he's guilty. Let's not say this.
Yeah.
And the defendant should have the burden of proving he's not guilty.
Yes.
That's what you're saying.
I think we're all pretty clear. Are you saying in sub 1, because I'm not sure if I can even understand sub 1, the last sentence. Is it one, the person that we're talking about there that has the burden of proof, is the burden of proof to prove whether he ought to be released or not?
That's right.
So that ought to be, if you're following Frank and Jim and myself, we'd say the defendant.
Yeah.
What I would feel, and then at sub two,
I think it is the state. Isn't that what you're talking about?
That's what I'm saying, but Jim's pointing out that this is only one hearing,
that's
and
right.
Three things can be determined.
But when the hearing is concluded, the judge says either you're safe and I'll release you, or he says you're dangerous, but I won't confine you, I'll supervise you. Or he says you're dangerous and I'll confine you. Now, obviously, if you say the defendant has the burden on sub one, what you have to be saying is if he doesn't maintain that burden, then the court obviously ends up finding two or three.
So yeah, you're right. I'm not
about
sure.
Provided the state has the burden, but that the existence of a verdict finding that he was not guilty by reason of insanity is prima facie evidence that he's dangerous.
I think that makes some sense.
Yeah, couldn't the procedure be set up when the jury has returned the verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity? We can either have a hearing or not a hearing. So the defense attorney, he sits there and he decides, okay, from my psychiatrist examination, they feel he's not insane now, he's no longer a danger now, so I'm going to request a hearing to present evidence on this. And then he would have the burden of showing this. Otherwise, or he may feel that his psychiatrist would show that although he is not a substantial danger, so he could be released, under supervision, put the burden on the defense to request this hearing. Otherwise, the court automatically commits.
Well, I don't know. Let's take a break for 5 minutes. That's going to resolve these questions.
Well,